Size Coop Live. Hi, I'm Irene Watson. I'm your host for today. Well, today I'm really delighted to be speaking on the phone with Leslie Du Temple. She is an author of a children's book titled Stars in the Water. Her inspiration came through First Nation tales, as well as her own love for nature and sense of wonder, and we're going to be talking about that today. Children of all ages love this book because it touches on things like legends and fairy tales. Of course, we love it. But before we chat with her, I'd like you to know a little bit more about her. Leslie Du Temple is an award-winning children's author of more than 24 books. She's written on subjects ranging from preschool counting book to An Idiot's Guide to an A&E biography, and her work has been quoted in Time magazine. Her newest book, the one that we're talking about today, Stars in the Water, is a collection of Northwoods legends based on the First Nation oral traditions. Hi, Leslie.
Hi there.
Well, I'm so glad to be talking to you. I always love to talk to authors that write children's books because it just takes a little extra imagination to be able to put something together to interest kids.
I love writing for kids, and it's not only a genre that's putting things together like that, but it's the younger you write for, the more precise you have to be in your writing. I've likened some of my books to basically writing haiku because you have to make every word count. In some of the books I've done for second graders, I'm limited to only 1,200 words in the entire book. So you're really kind of cutting it down, and you have to make it so concise. It's very challenging. I love writing for young kids because it's challenging.
Well, yeah, it is, because what I also find, too, that the kids either like it or they don't.
Oh, yes. They're nothing automatic in their judgment.
No kidding.
Yeah.
It's like, and they know exactly what they like and what they don't like. Now, Leslie, you have a lot of knowledge about the First Nation oral traditions, and you incorporate this into your writing.
I do, and that's actually a personal avocation or hobby, if you will. I live in an area that is actively inhabited at this point by the Ojibwa and or Chippewa tribes. They are both the same tribe. It's just different names. And I've spent a lot of time in Canada. So I've always kind of been very interested in how they relate to the land and just the whole oral tradition. It's fascinating to me, but it is a personal interest, a personal hobby.
You know, they are so connected to the land. I'm also originally from Canada, too, and I think probably the complete opposite direction from where you have spent time in. And we were surrounded by a lot of the Indians also, and ours were Cree settlements. But they are so connected, and they have so many traditions and, you know, stories that they pass down for generations and generations, because most of them are actually illiterate in the older, you know, people.
Oh, absolutely. And I love how magic is so matter-of-fact in all of the stories. And then when you start really looking at those stories, the magic is still there. It's all the same things are still there today. And is it really magic, or is it just a way of interpreting it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And are you finding, at least what I found in Western Canada, was that a lot of the younger people really got away from it, but what I'm hearing is happening now, this generation is now getting back to those oral traditions that have been passed down, and they're actually searching them.
Oh, I think that's true. So many of the oral traditions were really lost within the tribes, as I see it. I have very little native blood in me. I mean, I actually do have some. It goes back into Canada, in Quebec, in the Quebec area. But I think nowadays it is coming back, and it's a way to reconnect, and It's a new sort of generation, a new pride in what is the oral traditions. And so many of them were lost because there was at least one or two generations where it wasn't valued. And that is more of your, I think, your Caucasian or your invader, if you will, influence on that this was a bad thing to be, and therefore you were ashamed of it. And so I think some of these, the oral history was lost for a couple generations, and now you've got this pride coming back. But you also had some people I know there was someone from, I think, UBC, University of British Columbia. Her name escapes me at this point, but in the 1920s or 30s, she was going through and collecting the oral traditions and recording them. That's where actually some of the ideas or the seeds or kernels for the legends that I've been working with came from, in that she recorded some of these stories and put them down into print, not recording, of course, mm-hmm. not electrical. But they were only like maybe two or three sentences. And she has got these recorded, and you find other people like this, anthropologists who were traveling in the 20s and the 30s, and really trying to preserve some of these things. Emily Carr was doing it through painting in British Columbia. Uh-huh. And you do have some people who were doing the oral traditions, but they are very stripped down. But still, they're there to start with.
Exactly. You know, you just mentioned a few minutes ago, Leslie, about shame. And that is so true, because I started doing some genealogy way back when actually we still lived in Canada. And my daughter, our daughter, really felt that she had some Indian roots. And I knew on my side that that wasn't possible. You know, it just wasn't.
Yeah.
But on my husband's side, it was possible because his ancestors did come from the United States. And we were questioned. We questioned his family, and it was just like so adamant, no, there is no way. But when I started doing genealogy many years later again, and I found out that actually his fourth great-grandmother was a Cherokee Indian. And then we found some pictures, and all of a sudden we're putting a picture of our daughter next to the picture of her.
Oh, my God.
Great, exactly. great, whatever, grandmother.
Yes.
And they're identical.
Oh, my God.
Yes. And yes. So, you know, and all of a sudden it's like she says, see, I told you so. And
uh-huh.
But like you say, there was just that shame at one point because he just did not want to even
yeah.
admit.
My cousin has done some of our genealogical research and gotten it back. And where ours is coming from is our father's side.
Mm-hmm.
And her father, my uncle, you know, so we have the two fathers there. But it's on their side. And this is my dad's side of the family came originally from France and then migrated in going through Scotland and Wales and Ireland even a bit over to Quebec. And that's where you get the interminglings when they finally hit into the Quebec area, because I don't believe any of them were voyageurs, you know,
mm-hmm.
the French voyageurs, but there still was an intermingling. And my cousin has found a Huron female
mm-hmm.
in there. And it's like you say, it's at least five generations back.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, in the records it says it's a Huron Indian princess. Which, as we all know, you know, they didn't have princesses, you know, and it was, but
yeah.
it almost goes back to what you said about the shame, too.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
It was a way to make the intermarrying more acceptable.
Yes.
You know, at best, this might have been the daughter of a chief. Who knows?
Yeah,
you know, but
yeah.
we know that there is some Huron, there is a female who was of Huron
uh-huh.
descent. So,
Leslie, there's some, what do you feel about the relevance of the legends and the natural magic that is in today's world? You touched a little bit on the magic, but...
Oh, yes. Yeah, I think they are totally relevant. When I go into classrooms and talk to kids, one of the things I start off with is discussing the difference between a fairy tale and a legend. And I personally see fairy tales as more of a cautionary warning often, like don't take food from a stranger and do not go walking in the woods without any food and certainly don't leave a trail of gingerbread crumbs because they're going to get eaten and, you know, and just be careful, you know.
Uh-huh.
Don't talk to fish that talk. there's usually a lot of don'ts in fairy tales.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes you get the do. Do be kind, do be gracious, and things will work out. You know, Cinderella, basically.
Yeah.
But mostly you've got more like Snow White or Sleeping Beauty. I mean, you basically watch out, you know, Hansel and Gretel.
Uh-huh.
And yet with the legends, and I make a big distinction between fairy tales, like Sleeping Beauty, Snow White, Hansel and Gretel, and legends, which would be basically what the book Stars in the Water is about. Why do coyotes howl? Legends tend to be developed to answer a question about the natural world. And those questions and the attempt to answer them are still totally valid today, because the three stories that are in Stars in the Water, which is basically why do coyotes howl, how did the deer get black knees, and why do water lilies even exist in ponds? But any of those, you could take any other item, like why does the skunk have a white stripe down its back? And the reason I stress to these kids is that they're so totally valid today is that with all of our scientific advancements, all of our ability to separate the genome and DNA, we don't know why a skunk has a white stripe down its back. We don't definitively know why coyotes howl. So your guess is as good as anybody else, even a Nobel Prize winner, when it comes to developing a legend and trying to answer a question, or creating a legend to answer a question about the natural world. Why do pine trees grow so tall? And so I really stress with the kids when I'm doing classroom visits that legends are valid all the time. They're just as valid today as they were thousands of years ago when people were trying to answer these questions.
So what are some legends?
Oh, they show up everywhere. There's, I know I've seen books like The Legend of the Indian Paintbrush.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a flower.
Uh-huh.
You've got, I've seen one that was The Legend of a Daisy. Why do daisies have yellow centers or something like that? Of course, there's always the really standard one, the loon's necklace. You know, why do loons have those white dots around their neck? There are a lot of development of the earth legends, and those probably fall more into the religious or theological category than natural world or natural phenomenon, because you look at almost any First Nation, and they have a story as to how the earth came to be and how people came to be. Sometimes it's, and I'm probably going to get this wrong, but we'll just say hypothetically, sometimes it's Raven who has dived to the bottom of the water and pulled up the mud. Or the turtle who has stood there and all the other animals got on his back and finally we get to land and there we go, we have the humans. Or the clam and all the little humans emerged from this clam. That's one that... And there's a very well-known sculptor who is now deceased from the British Columbia area. I believe he was part of the Haida Gwaii. And his name is Bill Reed. And he has a beautiful statue in Vancouver. It's on the campus of UBC. And it is carved from wood, and it's large, you know, the size of a king-size bed and stands up. And it's the clamshell opening up and the humans coming out. So there's lots of legends as to, and they're not all natural phenomena, but they're all valid. They're all attempts to answer, you know, unanswerable questions.
And of course, you know, a legend starts way generations back, and as the story progresses through the generations, it's of course tweaked.
Yes, but you know, it's hard to catch those tweakings because they weren't recorded in a written form. And so it vanishes into the ether every time it's tweaked. That's kind of one of my pet peeves, although I do use it totally, of the computer. When you think back of all the original manuscripts that you have of Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald, you can see the progress of going from the first draft to the finished product. And with the computer, when you write on the computer, all you ever see is the finished product. And I think it does a disservice to beginning writers that, you know, they look at, oh, my gosh, I could never write that well. Well, yes, you could if you were writing the first draft. But that's what happens also with your oral traditions. You know, they get tweaked, but you can't see them any more than you see the changes on a computer.
So, Leslie, why do coyotes howl? What's the legend?
Oh, the legend is that Coyote falls in love with a star.
Really?
And he can't stand it. He's crazy with love for the star. And he manages to make his way to the top of a very high peak because he's been watching the star, and she seems to pass very close to the peak every night. And he gets up there and begs and pleads for her to, you know, talk to him. And she reaches down and grabs his hand and takes him into the sky with her. And as soon as he gets up there, he realizes, oh, this is bad, bad, bad. I should not be up here. The heavens, you know, the dark night, it's not a place for me. I should be back on earth with the people and the plants, and I should not be up here in this totally cold, dark silence. And he pleads, let me go, let me go, let me go. And she won't talk to him. Nobody, none of the stars are saying anything. They're just dancing across the sky, totally silent. And finally, the star lets him go. And he goes crashing to earth. And at that point, he is disillusioned. And so he is very angry with the star who has betrayed him. And consequently, at nights, when it's starry, he is out there chastising her. He is howling and very bitter that she betrayed him.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
It sounds like a story of humans.
Yeah. Spurned.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. Join us and hear both well-known and upcoming writers talking candidly about their life experience as well as the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, we strive to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are available 24/7 through Direct Podcast as well as MP3 download for your convenience. Please visit us on InsideScoopLive.com. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with Leslie DuTemple, author of Stars in the Water. It's a children's book, but it's a book for all ages. It's fun to listen to Leslie, isn't it? So stay tuned because there's just so much more to this interesting adventure with Leslie. So as I'm listening to this, I'm just reflecting back to when you were talking about the coyote howling. And I used to work for the police force when I was in Canada, and my office was just above the cells. And when the full moon came around and we happened to have some of the Indian people that were in jail for the night and it happened to be a full moon, there was a few of them, and it seemed to me that this was a recurring incident that would always happen. They'd be howling at the moon.
Hmm.
Yeah. So then we can go, you know, is this a legend? Is this there again a connection to the earth?
Yeah, is it a case of living in closer connection to the earth than
right.
people in an urban area are accustomed to?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And it's not even so much urban. Urban and rural are the broad brush distinctions. But it really comes down, because you can be just as connected to nature in the middle of New York City as you would be someplace else, in that it's your mindset.
Yeah.
You know, do you want to pay attention to what's going on around you?
Uh-huh.
But obviously it's a little easier if you're in a rural area. But, yeah, I think that may very well be a case of is someone more connected than another.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and it just always made me wonder when this would happen. And, you know, it always happened at the full moon. And it's like, wow, what really is going on? Now, speaking of rural life, you live in a rural community.
Oh, yes, I do.
Oh, yes, in the middle of nowhere?
I live in the middle of nowhere. I'm 47 degrees north. I live on the shore of Lake Superior, and Canada is about 80 miles over my horizon. And that's because I live on a peninsula that sticks out into the middle of Lake Superior.
Mm-hmm.
If I was more on the south shore of Lake Superior, I would be about 180 miles from Canada. But the Keweenaw Peninsula sticks at least 50 miles into the lake, and I'm up on the very tip of it. It's where Isle Royale National Park is. Isle Royale is an island that's a national park, and it's an international biosphere reserve also. And it's in Lake Superior. And it is about 50 by 9 miles,
mm-hmm.
50 miles long, 9 miles wide. And I can't see it from where I am, but this is where the boats take off to go out there. The National Park ferry boat leaves from Houghton, and the private ferry leaves from Copper Harbor. And my own little town has a population of 53. closest grocery store is about 20 miles away.
So let's talk about your connection to Mother Earth.
I live with the seasons and the light and the animals every single day. I currently have a very, very large bear prowling my property. I don't know which it is, but it's a very large bear because it has left its calling card twice. And it has also destroyed three of my feeders and our next-door neighbor. I do have neighbors, actually, even though I'm middle of nowhere. I've got neighbors. I can see their house during the wintertime because the deciduous trees drop their leaves. But, you know, they're not real close, but they're close enough. You know, I mean, we can see our houses. Anyway, our neighbor, he was out walking on the road and encountered the bear, and it scared the bejesus out of him. So we have this huge bear wandering around right now. And I have bald eagles. I have a nest that's just down the beach from me. And I have, deer. I got deer like crazy all over. And we also now have cougars. But they make themselves scarce. You know, they have moved around. But what I seem to spend a lot of time with myself is the birds. I have a lot of ravens that are kind of around all the time, talking to me, doing things. And the eagles. The eagles are really fun to watch. And I view eagles as interesting messengers. You know, the First Nation view of them is that they are carrying messages from the spirits.
Yes.
And so I just kind of perk up every time one of my eagles sails down the beach. You know, it's like, hi, how you doing?
And so what messages do you get?
Well, usually I interpret them personally as coming from deceased people, my guardian angels, if you will. My mother was very, very into, shall we say, eagles. She considered eagles to be something of her own totem. And so when I see the eagles, my mother died not quite 3 years ago. So when I see an eagle come through, I always usually say, hi, Mom, because that's just my own personal interpretation of it.
Ravens are also considered by the First Nation people as a very sacred bird as well.
Oh, yes, yes. And ravens kind of go either way. Usually they are considered to be good. Uh-huh. They're generally bringing you good tidings or whatever, whereas a hawk is considered to be warning you of danger.
Yeah.
You know, you have a hawk fly in front of your car or overhead, you better watch out. You know, the idea is, you know, pay attention. The hawk is telling you, pay attention. There's something coming up ahead. But ravens are not necessarily that. Ravens are usually doing good. And I love my ravens. They're big. They're so sure of themselves.
And they winter there, do they?
Oh, they do.
Yes.
Okay. I have my ravens around almost all year.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes they're not around as much, but I'm not sure I ever go a day without seeing a raven. And sometimes I have a lot of them, but I just love how confident they are. You know, they think nothing of coming up and sitting on the porch and, you know, having a chat. they're something else.
Life in the North Woods really fuels your creativity then.
It does, yeah.
Give me a day. What does your day look like?
Oh, my day? Well, I wake up generally fairly early in the morning. I don't set an alarm, but I'm usually awake by 7. And nowadays it's dark at 7. And I live right on Lake Superior, so that's the first thing I see, is I will see what the lake looks like. I will get up and make a cup of coffee. I'll deal with our dog. We have a dog that gets walked and hangs out with. And at that point, I usually go outside and go for a walk. After my cup of coffee is made, I will go outside, and often I have the dog with me for about 2 miles or so. We'll just walk down the beach and turn around when we're ready to turn around. And then I will work. You know, I sit down and I start writing on my computer. And my office is it's in the attic of our house, which is a finished attic. But I have a spectacular view of the lake from there because I'm up so high. And that's kind of my day. I will be outside quite a bit, even in the wintertime, because we get a lot of snow here. In the wintertime, my being outside will take the form of cross-country skiing or snowshoeing. But being outside generally figures into every part of my day. I'm lucky enough that I live in a beautiful place, so even if I don't go outside, it feels like I'm outside because of my windows and my view and things. But I am typically physically outside every day, too. And I write with this all around me. So even if I'm writing about, something, whales, let's
uh-huh,
say,
uh-huh.
You know, it doesn't, you know, obviously that has nothing to do with where I live, but it still is where I live influences how I write and my focus and everything, really. I mean, I love where I live.
Well, it sure sounds like it, Leslie. Leslie, tell our listening audience your website address.
Well, I have a website that's my name, www.leslydutemple, it's LeslyDutemple.com. That's maintained for me by the Authors Guild, of which I'm a member. And it doesn't have a lot on it, I have to confess that. You know, it's just sort of a courtesy that they maintain. And where you can really get the information, particularly on Stars in the Water and some of my other, you know, work that I'm working on at the moment, is at the Mud Minnow Press site. I'm a partner in Mud Minnow Press, and that is www.mudminnowpress, all one word, MUDMINNOWPRESS.com. And there's information about the book, Stars in the Water, there, and some upcoming books that are in progress right now, and just things that are going. And there's also a blog that can be accessed from that site that is mostly the subtitle of the blog's title is Musings from the Minnow, and the subtitle is Writing, Publishing, and Life in the North Woods. So it covers just about everything. And that's put out every week.
Uh-huh.
So that would give anybody more information on anything almost. And I can be contacted at either one of those sites, too.
Thank you so much, Leslie, for
thank you.
Being it's just been such an enjoyable time talking to you because, you know, I lived in the North at one time, so I can relate to a lot of things.
It's been fun talking to a former Canadian.
Right.
I've got the French Canadian through my blood here.
Well, and I came from Northern Alberta, and so, you know, north,
yeah.
And now I'm in a city, and yes, I can still connect with the earth.
Yes, I can.
It's
a state of mind.
Exactly.
Well, it really is.
So thank you. And listeners,
thank you.
We've been talking to Leslie DuTemple. She is the author of Stars in the Water, and as you've heard so far, she just has some really interesting thoughts and ideas and how she incorporates all these myths and legends into her book. So if you have a child or a grandchild, do check out this book. Again, it's Stars in the Water, and I'm sure that your child will really, really enjoy it. Thanks again for listening, and this is Irene Watson with Inside Scoop Live. Bye for now.